Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of People Pleaser. If you're watching on YouTube, this is my podcast that I've been doing for about 5 years now. There are lots of episodes of this podcast right here on my YouTube channel that you can watch. I'm doing a little different thing today. I'm sort of like pre-taping it, and then I'm releasing the tape. Normally, I just do a live stream, and I just release the live stream footage, but I'm doing like a pre-tape, and I'm going to see how that works out. I'm on the road. I'm not in my normal studio. I brought my lights with me, but I left my cloud lifter for my normal microphone at home, so I'm using a different microphone, and we're going to see how it all goes, okay? We're going to see how it all shakes out. But yeah, there are two podcasts that I host right here on this YouTube channel, if you are indeed watching on YouTube. One is People Pleaser with Austin Archer. There are a lot of episodes of People Pleaser on this channel. And the other is a podcast I just started with my best friend, Kramer England. It's called The Oneer, and we break down movies. And that's all that is. The Oneer is just two white guys talking about movies because you know you needed another one of those, right? Nobody's doing that, okay? But we are. We're bringing that to you. But that's not what I'm talking about today. That's just a little bit of an intro. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, hello to you out there in the listening world. We got a live studio audience of about 70 people going up and down between 70 and 100 people on TikTok. Hello, everybody on TikTok. What's up? Today we are talking about... I think the title of the episode that's ruminating in my mind is The Terrible Endgame of Justified Resentments. What do I mean by that? I'm going to start out with a little anecdote here, okay? If you follow me on Instagram or on TikTok, you've probably seen recently, maybe you have, videos of me dancing at dance class at Millennium Studios in LA. It's something that I do 2 to 3 times a week. I've been doing it for a little over a year, and it's been like totally life-saving. I love dancing. It's so good for my mental and physical health. I got a bad back, and nothing's better for my back than moving regularly, and especially dance class. It's been really cool to get back into dance. I was a professional choreographer throughout my 20s, and I kind of just left the dance world, not on purpose. I just stopped working as a dancer or as a choreographer, and I sort of fell out with it, and I just got back into it in the last year or so. There is a new music video out, by the way. This is a little another little self-promo here. I have a new music video out, not for a song that I wrote, but it's a band called Sego. The song is called Tandang, T-A-N-D-A-N-G. And you can find that on YouTube, or you can find it at the links in any of my bios. I'll link it in the description of this video on YouTube. I directed and choreographed that video with my friend Kayla Janssen, who teaches all of the dance classes that I go to at Millennium, and we're also both in the video. Really, really proud of it. Really excited about it. I feel like it's some of my best work. It's a 5-minute long, unbroken one take, a single shot, and I think that it's right up there with some of the great music videos by OK Go, or that Jungle music video that went viral like a year ago. It's a fantastic dance music video. I feel extremely confident with it. Go check it out. But that's not what this anecdote is. This anecdote is, I was at dance class recently, okay? And it was the end of class, and we were setting up our cameras to film ourselves. This is something that happens every single class. We learn a routine, and then there's time set aside at the end of class to film yourself doing the routine. Now, it's crowded in that room. Kayla Janssen's dance class is very popular because she's the shit. She's the bomb. She's the goat. And so a lot of people want to take dance from Kayla, which means that if you want to film, you got to kind of be aggressive and stake out your spot in the room. Like, if it's time to film and you want to film, you got to get up there and get your camera set up before other people do, because there's only room up there on the mirror for like maybe 10 cameras to be going. And there's always at any given time, like at least 20 people who are dancing. So if you want to be one of the 10 cameras that gets a shot, you got to get in there. I always, like, I'm the first person in there every single time it's time to film, because I want to get the spot that I want. I want to get the proper amount of space to make sure that my My shot is all set up and I want to stake my spot on the floor. I want to make sure that, like, hey, I have claimed this spot on the floor. And it really is, it's proper dance class etiquette is first come, first serve. And that's the same with, like, throughout the class. Like, if you want to be front and center in the middle while learning the routine, you got to get there at the appropriate time to stake out your spot on the floor. It's bad etiquette if you show up first to class and you get a front and center spot, and 5 minutes into the warm-up, somebody comes in and they just stand right in front of you, like 2 feet right in front of you. That's bad etiquette. Like, you got there on time and you staked out that spot. That person who's 5 minutes late needs to find a spot in the back of the class. Like, that's just how that goes. First come, first serve. Anyway, it's the same with filming. Like, especially with filming, because I'm getting the shot of me, right? Like, I'm trying to film this to put it on social media. This is a new little piece of content that I'm doing. Yeah, it's cringe. Yeah, it's self-serving. Yeah, it's me showing off for my ego, whatever. But it's a thing, okay? It's like people filming themselves at the gym doing their squat reps and they're hitting their PR. I gotta get my video. Anyway, there's a guy who I go to class with regularly, we're in this class together regularly. And the other day, I set up my camera, again, first person, I get my camera all set up, and I have my camera set up for like a minute before the song even starts, because Kayla's like giving us a little like speech about things that she wants to see on this pass and everything like that. I've got everybody, it's clear. Everybody's cameras are set. Everybody has their spot. Everybody's got enough space. We are set. The song starts. The music's going. We're like 2 8-counts away from beginning the routine. I kid you not. We're like about to start. And as we're coming into the final stretch, this guy just moves from the sidelines right in front of me and stands right in front of my camera and in front of me. And I have like one measure of eight to tell him, ooh, 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 I've got a camera there. Could you step to the side? So I turn around and I do. I go, hey, ooh, I've got a camera. Can you step to the side? And he just looks at me and goes and just shrugs and then just does the dance right in front of me, right in front of my camera. And I just, I bailed. I didn't even do the routine. I just walked away. And on this day, I wish I could tell you that I was emotionally well-regulated enough and well-behaved enough that I just let it slide, that I just went, you know what, whatever. That was bad behavior on that guy's part. That was bad etiquette, but it's not going to solve anything if I address it with him. There's no way for me to try to approach this that won't result in some kind of awkward friction. But that's not what I did, unfortunately. What I did is I approached him and I tried my very best in the calmest way I could. And I was, you know, it was one of those things where like, I was already kind of out of breath because we'd been dancing and exercising, but then I'm trying to be really calm, but also I'm not calm at all. And I approached this guy and I go, hey, you just stood right in front of me and right in front of my camera. I just wanted to let you know that you, like, last minute, right before the song started, you kind of just stood right in front of me. And I'm trying my best to sound reasonable and not the most rude or obnoxious or entitled. But then his response is, so what? It's a dance class. People get in front of you sometimes. Like, sorry. And I just was like, oh no. Because he goes, what am I supposed to do? There's only so many spaces. Like, sometimes people get in front of you. And I go, no. I pointed out to you that I was filming. Like, I had the spot. I staked out the spot. What you're supposed to do is not that. What you're supposed to do is not jump in front of me. That's what you're supposed to do. And we start kind of like getting into it. Like, he's like, and he's just like, I'm sorry. I apologize. What do you want from me? I'm sorry. And I was like, no. You said, what can I do? And now we're like jawing back and forth at each other. And it, look, long story short, it didn't end well. It did, like, we didn't resolve it. We didn't like find a resolution. Like, class ended and I went back up to this guy knowing that this class is very important to me and knowing that me and this man attend class together regularly. and knowing that I don't want to have that bad energy, I go up to him to apologize and I go, I'm really sorry about that. I just, you know, I just want you to be aware of when people are filming and just like, you know, try to be conscious of that. And he looks at me and goes, I don't know what you want me to tell you. I don't know what you want me to tell you. Sometimes people dance in front of you. And I'm like, oh, and it happens again. Like as I'm trying to fix it, as I'm trying to apologize, he's still like doubling down. Like what? Sometimes people get in front of you. And I'm like, no, that's not how that works. Especially when people are filming. It's not just like, whoops, sometimes I stand right in front of you at the last second. That's a dick move. The moral of this story, the point of this story is, of this anecdote is, I had, there's people in the comments going like, what a POS and stuff like that. And somebody says, you're more regulated than me. I would have told him to move in a very loud voice. Somebody says next time he will get checked physically. Look, I resonate with these responses. Trust me. Because there is nothing I love more. There's nothing I get more juiced on than a justified resentment. Than like knowing that I have been wronged and that I am in the right to act out. And that is what this situation is. It's a small, inconsequential thing. It is a social faux pas at a dance class. It's someone acting with bad etiquette at a dance class that I go to. And now because I chose to address it with this person, there's potentially going to be a weird energy between me and him going forward. And I don't really know how to fix it. I've considered all different kinds of things. Like, do I just write him like a note, like a sorry note and like put in like a $20, you know, Starbucks gift card or something and just go like, listen, I don't want bad blood. This class is really important to me and I don't want, you know, I don't know. I've literally, the point of the story is I acted out on this justified resentment. And the result was not, it didn't fix anything. I'm not like, it's not like, oh, now my video wasn't ruined. It doesn't go back and retroactively change the fact that I didn't get a good video of that routine because he stood in front of me. It doesn't fix that. And it doesn't make me feel better. I'm not like, well, good thing I let him know. Now I'm just like, shit. I've got to go back to dance class with this guy 2-3 times a week and know that like he thinks I'm a total asshole because I kind of was. Even though it wouldn't have happened if he had just behaved not like an asshole in the first place. I have a justified resentment in this situation. This is the problem with justified resentments is you can absolutely make the case that I had every right to say what I said to this guy, that I had every right to go even further, that I had every right to do what people in the comments are saying I should have done and like physically checked him out of the way, said move really forcefully, or like gotten even more mad and been like, no, like there's nothing that I am more driven by than like being right and making sure that people acknowledge that I'm right when I know I'm right. This is why I have a hard time staying out of the comment section on the internet is like when someone is wrong and I know that I have the better argument, I need them to acknowledge it. And I can't just walk away because I know I've got the receipts, I've got the proof, I've got the stronger argument, and I know they got nothing. And I need the world to see that I am correct, that I have the high ground, that I have the higher position. And I can't let it go. I can't walk away because the allure of that justified position, that justified resentment is just too good. It's too attractive. It's like, no, but I'm right here. This is the point of what I'm talking about this episode, okay? That was just kind of a silly little anecdote from my life about this altercation I had at dance class. To take it in a completely different direction in a much more somber, much more serious tone, recently, Israel launched its latest attack in this year-long bombing campaign against innocent civilians in Gaza. This was an attack on a refugee camp, and some people may have seen the video. Some people may have just heard about it online or read about it. In my opinion, I don't think you need to watch it, but if you have seen it, then you know what I'm talking about. The video features people in a refugee camp in hospital beds trying to recover from injuries they sustained from previous attacks, burning alive in their hospital beds, burning to death. How am I going to connect my petty, pithy dance class story to this? The question on my mind when I watch proud Zionists trying to defend this attack from Israel, trying to say why it's okay that Israel did this, when I see people in the comments section saying, well, they shouldn't have, you know, shouldn't have done October 7th if they didn't want it. If they didn't want the smoke, they shouldn't have started it. When I see how people try to justify some of the most egregious, atrocious, inhumane crimes against humanity imaginable, when I think about how does that happen, I think about justified resentments. I think about an entire culture where the main fuel to the ideology, I think that the main fuel to the ideology of Zionism is justified resentment. I think the entire culture, the entire ideology is built around a people who have recognized themselves as a globally marginalized minority that has been historically oppressed with extreme prejudice. They have been through extreme hardship and suffer at the hands of bigotry worldwide on the global stage. They are constantly defending themselves and their identities from bigots and from abuse and from, you know, attacks. And what this results in is an entire culture that says, nobody in the global community can tell us shit about how we are allowed to respond to what we experience. It's justified resentment. It's the feeling of, you haven't been through what I've been through, so you need to zip your lip. You don't get to say anything about my behavior because you haven't been where I've been. That's how you convince an entire culture of millions of people to condone this kind of violence and this kind of like wanton destruction and disregard for the dignity of human life. It's through justified resentment. And this is why I say, like, you know, when we talk about the end game of justified resentment, because it can be as small and petty as following someone who cut you off in traffic and being like, no, that person's wrong. I'm correct in this instance. That person almost killed me. They almost killed both of us. That person was not paying attention and they put both of our lives at risk. I'm going to follow them. And when they get out of their car, I'm going to let them know because I am in the right. It can be as small as that. And it can be as big as, no, I'm allowed to use the full might of my military that I can control against these people because they started some shit. And don't start some shit if you don't want some shit. And it's the same thing extrapolated out. It is the exact same phenomenon of acting out on a justified resentment, on a victim narrative, on being able to establish. And when I say victim narrative, I think that's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way or ruffle a lot of feathers. But it is being able to establish a credible victim narrative. In that story that I told you about my dance class, I am establishing a credible victim narrative. I am credibly, by all metrics, in the right there. I am the victim. Somebody else was doing harm to me first. Therefore, I have now gained justification to react however I want. And it is so, in the human psyche, there is nothing more alluring to me than there's nothing more difficult to avoid than pursuing a justified resentment, than deciding that I am going to act out on it because I deserve to, I get to, and nobody can tell me that I'm in the wrong. And that's, I genuinely believe that that is at the core of what fuels Zionism as a cultural ideology, is this idea of us against the world. We have more than enough evidence to establish a credible victim narrative for ourselves as a globally oppressed minority. We don't need to take shit from anybody, and we don't need to hear from anybody about why our behavior is wrong. And what we can clearly see on the outside of it, witnessing it, is your behavior is absolutely wrong. It does not matter what you have suffered in the past. Nothing could possibly justify what you are doing now. And even if you're capable of justifying it in your brain to yourself, in your heart to yourself, are you actually fixing anything? Are you actually going back and retroactively erasing the wrongs that were done to you? Is burning people alive in their hospital beds fixing what was done in the Holocaust? Is that undoing it? Is that undoing the pain? Is it somehow curing the illness of that kind of violence? Or is it just multiplying it? Just exponentially multiplying it? And I think that the answer is very clearly and unequivocally the second thing. It is not a solution. It is not a cure. It is not in any way addressing the problem of the wrongs that were done to you as a people to carry out this kind of wanton destruction and violence. But it is justified through a credible victim narrative and through an attachment to an understandable and justifiable resentment. And I think that this is sort of the core of what I want to talk about, because I'm going to go a step further here. I think a lot of people in my chat are with me right now going, hell yeah, absolutely. I hear you, Austin. I hear you. I'm with you on that. And now I'm going to take it a step further, and I want you to keep that same energy and stay with me on this. Because people who are voting in protest in November because of the United States government's support of Israel, saying, I will not support this, fuck that, you can't get my vote. If you're going to do that, I'm going to, you know, I'll burn the whole country down before I support that. It is the exact same pattern and behavior. What is happening is you feel you have been credibly wronged by the United States government and their support of Israel's genocide. You have established a credible victim narrative. These people in my name have taken my tax dollars and funded something that I find to be repugnant and abhorrent, and that is so deeply insulting to me. I feel so deeply wronged by that, that I will never support these people with my vote ever again. And I don't care what the fallout of that decision is. I don't care if I'm throwing queer people under the bus when I do that. I don't care if I'm throwing people with a uterus under the bus when I do that. I don't care if I'm throwing the middle class under the bus when I do that. I don't care what the fallout is. I have a justified resentment. I have a justified bone to pick with the Democratic Party, with the Biden-Harris administration and their refusal to do more sooner, to enact an arms embargo sooner. And listen, I want you to understand, you do have a justified resentment. It is an understandable human emotion and reaction. And again, I'm taking this all the way back to me reacting to a guy standing in front of me at dance class. It's understandable for me to say, that's not right. I did things right here. I got the spot. I staked it out. I set up my camera and I claimed my spot. And then you came and you just stole it from me last second, and that's not right. And I have every right to let you know and to act out. And that's correct. That is my reaction. There is a normal and appropriate human reaction. And your reaction to seeing what is being done in your name with your tax dollars by your government saying, that disgusts me, that offends me, is a normal and appropriate human reaction. I want to make that really, really clear. You can establish a credible victim narrative by saying, I have been credibly wronged by this government acting in these ways in my name with my money. And because of that, I am justified in acting out, in seeking retribution. It's a very, very normal, very, very understandable, very sympathetic human response. The problem with it is, just like the ideology of Zionism and Israel's response to their global oppression as a people, as a culture, as a government, as a military, your protest vote does not do anything to cure the wrong that was done to you or the wrong that is being done to the people in Gaza. It does not result in any material gain for anyone. It doesn't end the cycle. It doesn't stop what's happening. It just continues to multiply it. Responding to violence with resentment. Violence with resentment. Violence happens. We establish a credible victim narrative. We establish a justified resentment. We respond with violence. That violence happens. The person who is receiving the violence establishes a credible victim narrative, establishes a justified resentment, and responds with violence. It just goes on and on and on. We talk about the cycle of trauma, the cycle of abuse in society. A person who is raised by abusive parents who were raised by abusive parents, who were raised by abusive parents, who were raised by abusive parents. And the cycle just continues. My life was not fair. I was born into a family that did not treat me properly. My parents didn't treat me the way that parents should treat a child. I did not receive the proper love and care that a child deserves. I have established a credible, viable, real victim narrative, and I am entitled to that narrative. And that narrative is understandable and sympathetic. I am entitled to act out because of that. And nobody can tell me shit about how I should be behaving, about whether or not my behavior is good or bad or helpful. I don't care. That's what's going on here. That's what's going on. At some point, somebody needs to step in and break the cycle. At some point, somebody needs to step in and say, yeah, I've absolutely got a justified resentment here. Yeah, I'm definitely mad. I'm definitely pissed off, and I definitely deserve to be pissed off. Yeah, I'm sad and frustrated and disappointed and angry. But unless I approach this in a different way, nothing's going to get fixed. I know that a lot of third-party voters and protest voters believe that what they are doing is trying to opt for the different way, trying to do something different. I've said this in past episodes of this podcast and in different videos on my channel, talking about the power of voting in a coalition. Here's the thing. People always go, well, if we just try things your way, which is just, oh, vote harder this time, vote blue no matter who, just keep on voting, that's just upholding the status quo. My response to that is and always will be, we've actually never actually tried the strategy properly, which is we actually vote consistently election cycle after election cycle. This is something we've never been able to do because every other election cycle, we feel so aggrieved that, you know, we gave our vote to whatever party the time before and they didn't show up for us in every way we wanted them to. They let us down. They disappointed us. We feel like we have a justified resentment against them. So to spite them, we vote against them. We vote third party. We throw a protest vote and they wind up losing and we cede power to the right again. And then we do this sort of power seesaw back and forth. And right now, the political Overton window in America is shifted so far to the right, and people on third-party voters and protest voters love to talk about this. Hey, why does everything keep shifting to the right? The reason why that happens is because far-right extremism, being as extreme as you possibly can be on the far-right end of the political spectrum in America, That is a viable political position. You can win elections while being a far-right authoritarian extremist. And as long as that is the case, there is no incentive for the right half of the political spectrum to ever shift their platforms and their policies, even an iota, to the left. And as long as they are comfortably sitting on the far extreme right of the spectrum, as long as they are comfortably winning elections over there, it means that in order to get a large enough piece of the voting block to be competitive, the Democratic Party, the opposition party, needs to shift their platform to the right. They need to, it pulls them toward the center and even right of center. That's what happens. If you want to move the Overton window to the left, if you want to push it to the left, you need to be willing to do the hard thing. Don't act out on a justified resentment. Don't, obviously you are justified in acting out, but don't do that. Be the adult in the room and say, even though I'm mad at you, and even though I have every right to be mad at you, and even though I'm disappointed in you, and even though I have every right to be disappointed in you, and even though I'm disgusted by your behavior, and I have every right to be disgusted by your behavior, I'm going to do the thing that I believe has the best chance of changing this cycle. And I'm going to deprive the far right extremist maniacs from the chance of having power ever again. I'm just going to starve out that position and force them to shift left if they want to remain competitive. If they want to still win elections and be viable, they're going to have to shift left, because we are going to starve them of power. We're not going to let them win another election being that far right, which means if they want to be competitive in the election world, in the American electoral system, they're eventually going to have to shift their politics to be more progressive. But as long as we keep letting them regain power, there's no incentive for anything to ever shift left. And the only reason why that keeps happening, why we keep going back and forth, is because of the relatively small contingent of voters who act out on justified resentments, who say, nah, dude, I don't like what you're doing in my name. I don't like how you're spending my money, and fuck you for that. I'm gonna take this whole thing down if I have to. I don't care. This country doesn't represent me. This government doesn't represent me, and I don't care. I don't care if people lose health care. I don't care if people lose access to gender affirming care. I don't care. I don't care if books get banned in schools. I don't care if we stop being able to teach kids about slavery. I don't care if drag gets banned. I don't care if abortion gets banned across the world. I'm mad. I deserve to be mad, and I get to act however I want because I'm mad. The cycle's got to end at some point. At some point, you've got to be able to take the slight, recognize the natural human emotion of frustration and anger, and act differently and respond differently. That's the only way. You've got to break the cycle. Somebody has to. Let's go to the comments. We got somebody who says, LMAO at thinking it's a single issue and not connected. I'm really glad this is our first comment, because this is something I wanted to talk about as well, is single issue voting. And I get how everything's connected. I get how, the corruption of the whole system is interconnected. But here's my problem with single issue voting. Again, you know, I get the emotional position. I get how it's like, I disagree with what's being done in my name, and that makes me mad, and I want to act out on that. I absolutely understand it. I want to punish these people for doing wrong. It's the same way all the way down the line. Israel, we're tired of being a globally oppressed minority of people, and we want to act out, and we deserve to, and you can't tell us shit. It goes down and down and down the line. This is how white supremacists feel. They're like, I feel like I'm tired of seeing that white men are the bad guys in all the movies that I watch. I'm sick of this. I'm tired of everybody villainizing. I feel like it's justified resentments all the way down. I get it. But here's the thing with single issue voting, with like having this hard line stance, is there's sort of this inescapable hypocrisy that you're going to run into at some point. There's two ways we can look at this. One is, I have a hard line. I want my hard line is I want the United States to immediately enact an arms embargo and to sever its ties with Israel and, you know, basically strong arm Israel into ending their genocide. Unless that happens, they will not have my support. That is my hard line. Okay, let's hypothetically assume that that happens tomorrow, that it's done. It's done in exactly the way that you want it to be done. Does that mean that, I mean, do you not have hard lines on any other issues? If we go down the line then to go, okay, what are other existential issues that sort of completely threaten the survival of not just, you know, one group of people, but all people? Let's look at climate change. Let's look at nuclear weapons. Let's just look at, like, war. Couldn't you then just move the goalposts to, okay, cool, we accomplished that. Now you can't have my vote unless you absolutely agree to all of these things that are going to address climate change in the next 20 years. Like, it has to be done today, 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 in this exact way. Otherwise, I can't do it because this is an even bigger threat. This is a bigger existential threat than what's happening in Gaza. This is the entire planet, the entire species being threatened. And what winds up happening is, like, you keep pushing that can down the road. You keep moving that target and moving that goalpost. And eventually it's like there is nothing that you can concede on unless it is done 100% the way that you need it to be done. Like, if you want to be intellectually consistent about it or ideologically consistent about it, you need to have the same hardline stance on all of those issues. There can be no compromise or areas where you're willing to take a little bit less to get another thing done or to protect another, you know, like, well, I'll take a little bit less here to make sure that these people over here are protected properly, even though that's not ideal. And eventually you're left with a political position that's completely unviable. That's just like, well, now there is no political party or platform or campaign that can actually satisfy your needs as a voter, because everything has to become a hard line. And if everything isn't a hard line, somebody just wrote stalemate. Absolutely, stalemate. And if everything isn't a hard line for you, if it's just like this one issue, if it's just like, no, it's just this thing, then, like, then your position lacks ideological consistency. There is obvious hypocrisy in that. Like, you are willing to make concessions on some existential threats, or on, you know, some people maybe losing rights or being treated in a way that is unacceptable, but you're not willing to make concessions in other areas. And, like, I think if you're gonna be a hardliner, so that person said, you know, LMAO at thinking it's a single issue. I get that it's not a single issue, but that's sort of the problem, right? Is, like, once your single issue is addressed, you've got to move on to the next thing, and you've got to approach that with the same level of ideological rigidity. And eventually it's like, when you're trying to design a political campaign that's meant to appeal to over 80 million people, there just is no political platform that is going to perfectly address every single concern of all of those people. Most times, the majority of those people are going to be making concessions. They're going to be saying, this is not perfect. This is not ideal. Maybe even, this is far from perfect. This is far from ideal. But it's the best viable option I have. And I have to go with the best viable option. The other way you can look at single issue voting is you can say, you know, the first way I looked at it was, okay, let's say your issue gets addressed perfectly, then what? Moving from there, let's take it the other way and say, let's say your single issue is absolutely off the table. It's not going to be addressed. Are you willing to then say, okay, that's off the discussion table. What else can I get in this negotiation? Can I move on to my next item down the list and see what else is in play? And if the answer is no, then again, you have a stalemate. Like, you are barring yourself from participating in progress in any meaningful, productive way. And you're doing it because you have decided that you are justified. You have established a credible victim narrative. You have a credible grievance that is totally understandable on a human and emotional level. And because of that, you have decided that unless my grievance is addressed 100% to my satisfaction, I just simply won't. I'll just take nothing. I'll see everybody die if I can't get my way. And I don't see how you hold that position and still try to claim any kind of moral superiority. Because I don't see that position as being the morally superior position. I just don't. Even Steven says, we're so obsessed with having a moral superiority that we but can't agree on, and I think that the comment cut off, but yeah, can't agree on, like, you know, how to go about that. That's the problem, is like the actual like morally superior and ethically superior move is to not act out on your justified resentment. It feels counterintuitive. It feels like you're like letting this atrocious grievance slide. And how could you do that? How could that be morally superior? But it's because if you actually investigate what the end game is, what the fallout is of people acting out on justified resentments, it's never good. It never actually serves the greater good. It's always better to find a way to do the least harm. You know, people always talk about the lesser evil. I think we need to talk more about the greater good. Sweaty Letty says, people can't debate without losing their shit. Boy, is that ever true in this election cycle. Like, we can't have a conversation. And this is why, like, I talked about this with someone on Threads the other day, that, like, it's an emotional position. Somebody said to me on Threads, they went in the comments and they said, would you tell a person whose family was killed in Gaza that they should vote for Kamala Harris over Donald Trump? Would you tell them that? And I said, I would understand their emotional position of not wanting to support someone who has directly supported the murder of their family. That is an entirely understandable human position. The emotional position is rock solid. It's airtight. It is inarguable. And nobody can actually tell them not to feel the way that they feel. The way that they feel is the appropriate way to feel. But I would also say that on the outside of that emotional reality, there is another reality, and that is that paving the way for a second Trump presidency in no material way, paving a way for a second Trump presidency to spite the Biden-Harris administration because you have a justified resentment, because you have a justified emotional reality there, in no way addresses the wrongs that were done to you, and in no way is a solution. It doesn't fix anything. It might satisfy some kind of desire for revenge, for vengeance, some kind of desire for to punch back that we all feel, some kind of primal emotional desire, but it doesn't actually function in any way as a step toward progress, as a step toward a solution. If anything, it is a step back. It is something that is only going to multiply the harm that was done to you and cast out even more harm on even more people. And that person said, what's emotional about it? It's literally like, this person supported the murder of my family. What's emotional about it? And the reality is, like, everything. It's entirely emotional. Everything about it is emotional. The only thing that is there is the emotional reality of it. And again, let me be clear. I'm not saying, like, it's bad to have an emotional response to things, or like you're wrong for having an emotional response to things, but that's what it is. Because the unemotional reality of it is, as shitty as it is that this administration supported that, you are better off and safer with a Kamala Harris presidency than you are with a Donald Trump one. That is the cold, hard, unemotional reality of it. And yeah, the unemotional reality kind of fucking sucks. It's not super cool. Like, it's not like it, like, it sucks to break something down like that. It feels so inhumane. But weirdly, on the other side of that is like, well, but wouldn't the humane thing be to try to figure out a way to move forward in a way that is going to minimize harm going forward, that is going to keep the most possible people safe going forward? I think it feels like it taps into this obsession with retributive justice that we have as a culture and as a society, that we want to punish people for doing wrong. And that's what it is like, no, the Biden-Harris administration, Kamala Harris, does not deserve to be rewarded for what she has done. She deserves to be punished. We believe that there is some kind of virtue and some kind of pragmaticism, practicality in punishment. I see this online all the time, like videos of like a bully who's like picking on some kid, and then some bigger kid comes along and like knocks the bully to the ground and like, you know, slams him into the pavement. They're like, taught that bully a lesson, showed them. And I always think like, I wonder if that kid actually went, boy, I learned my lesson today. I'm never going to do that ever again. Or if it just compounds the violence and multiplies it. Every story that I've ever seen of a person, of a violent criminal being rehabilitated and being, you know, growing out of a violent life and into a life that can be productive and meaningful, is not born out of punishment. It's not like, oh, geez, I went to prison and I got my ass kicked several times in the yard. I just really got the shit kicked out of me, and I realized I was wrong for being a violent criminal, and I changed my ways. Every person I've ever talked to, every story I've ever seen of a person who has actually been rehabilitated and changed was because someone decided to get rid of the idea that I need to punish you and start looking at you as a human being and start saying, setting aside the fact that you did wrong, that you caused great harm in your life, how can we look past that and find the humanity here? How can we move forward in a productive way? And actual change always comes from breaking that cycle of violence. Retribution, punishment, that's just a perpetuation of the cycle of violence. That is just more violence. What you crave when you crave punishment, when you crave retribution, is you crave violence to be done to those who did violence to you. You crave the perpetuation of the violent cycle. Again, the emotional reality of why you crave that is so understandable. It's so valid. It's so inarguable. It's so deeply human. But it's also massively unproductive and does not actually serve the purpose you want it to serve. Nick James asks, so what's the humanity you see in Trump then? I don't know if you're talking to me or talking to another commenter. It sounds like you might be talking to another commenter, because the answer I have is none, is very, very little. He's one of the least human people I think I've ever encountered. And, you know, there's it's very hard to find actual humanity on the right half of the political spectrum in America, but it starts with him. He is the shining beacon of kind of humanity struggle with, you know, compassion and kindness. And I just don't see him as a solution in any way. I can see how you could want to punish the Democratic Party by letting him be elected and say, I don't give a shit. You guys deserve to be punished. I can see that desire. I don't think that punishment is actually a feasible or pragmatic route toward progress. I don't think it ever has been. Again, we talk about cycles of abuse with children and with people. Abusing your kid because you were abused does not end the cycle of violence. It perpetuates it. Somebody's got to break the cycle, guys. Somebody's got to be the adult in the room. Somebody's got to be the change they want to see in the world. All right, so Tracy Berry says, Jill Stein for president, and if she can't get it now, then it will unfortunately go to Trump. But, no but. The comment cut off there, but. No Jill Stein for president. What you are doing there is saying, I want to punish the Democratic Party. I feel like they deserve to be punished. I have a justified resentment. I have a credible victim narrative, and nobody, ain't nobody, least of all some mustache-having, mullet-having white guy on the internet, can tell me nothing. Nobody can tell me that I'm not allowed to act out on my justified resentment. So Jill Stein for president. Here's the problem. Jill Stein for president does fuck all for every single issue you actually care about. It does not address the problems you care about. It is not a solution. You said, if she can't get it now. There is no if. She cannot get it now. I'm sorry to tell you. I'm sorry if somehow I'm the person breaking this to you. The goal of her campaign is to try to get 5%. She's currently polling at like 1.7%. They're not trying to win. They're trying to establish a credible viability for Green parties going forward. There is no if she can win in this election. She knows she can't win. The question is if she can get 5%. And even then, there's no guarantee that that strategy is going to work because it's been done before. Ralph Nader got 8% of the vote, of the third party vote. Didn't change the duopoly. Didn't challenge the establishment powers of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. When you are voting for a potential future, for a pie-in-the-sky future, as a means of punishing the Democratic Party for the wrongs that you feel like you've suffered, for the ways that they've wronged you, you are abandoning all of the things that you say you care about in the name of enacting that punishment. I get it. You feel justified. And in many ways, I can't argue with you. You are. I'll give it to you. You are justified. Your resentment is justified. They have wronged you. They have used your tax dollars in egregiously wrong ways. I'm not here to argue with you on that. Jill Stein's not the answer. She does not solve any of the problems that you have. She does not provide any practical route toward progress. It's just acting out on a justified resentment, which is satisfying. Boy, is it satisfying. Oof. Boy, is it, it's so satisfying, but all, it's satisfying in the short term. I'll tell you, following someone who cuts you off in traffic and rolling your window down and getting their attention and telling them, fuck you, in that quick little hit is satisfying. And then you drive away realizing, what the fuck is wrong with me? What did I just accomplish? Do I think I showed that person? Do I think that that person drove the rest of the way home going, oh man, I can't believe I cut the... Do I actually think I contributed? Did I put some good into the world? Or did I just scratch an itch for retributive justice that I had while actually not contributing anything meaningful? Here's a question. This is Jacob asking, what thoughts do you have about the Working Families Party, just in general? Here's what I'll tell you, Jacob. My thoughts on the Working Parties family is I just heard for the first time in your comment that the Working Parties family is a thing that exists. And you could say, oh, well, that's, you know, that's just that. Chalk that up to your political ignorance, Austin. You're a guy who talks about politics on the internet for professionally. This is what you do. How do you not know about the Working Parties Families Party? And hey, my bad. My bad for not being informed, but what that tells you is your party isn't a thing. If they were big enough and significant enough and influential enough and powerful enough to actually matter and to actually have a chance of actually being a real player on the political stage, I would have heard of them. I'm sorry. I don't have to go out of my way to know who Donald Trump is and to know who Kamala Harris is. I don't have to go and do a bunch of like, okay, I've heard about this Kamala Harris person. Let me make sure I've read up on her. The whole world knows who she is. The whole world knows who Donald Trump is. The whole world knows what the Democratic Party is and what the Republican Party is. I can't tell you how many times I've been talking about a third party candidate and somebody in my comments is like, who? And I'm like, exactly. Exactly. Who? People say who about Jill Stein? Jill Stein is probably the most popular third-party candidate right now in this race. She probably was in 2020 and even in 2016. And people are still like, who? Three elections of Jill Stein, and my dad is always like, who is Jill Stein? And I'm always just like, exactly. Exactly, Dad. Who is Jill Stein indeed? So when you ask me my thoughts on the Working Families Party, it's that, unfortunately. Who are they? What is that? Might be like, I don't know, maybe you got a million people who are stoked on the Working Families Party. Maybe. I don't know. There's 350 million people in America. You need a lot more people to understand what your party is before. Here's the thing is, as a political commentator, there's no point in me talking about the Working Family Party. There's no point in me even entertaining it until they're actually a thing, until they're actually a real serious competitor. And that's the only reason I ever talk about Jill Stein is because she's got almost 2%, which is like barely enough to notice. It's like barely enough to be like, okay, Cool, I'll bite. Let's talk about Jill Stein. Let's talk about how Jill Stein takes money from Lockheed Martin. Let's talk about how Jill Stein is pals with Vladimir Putin. Let's talk about how Jill Stein only doesn't have AIPAC money because AIPAC has never offered her money because she's not a serious political candidate. Let's talk about how Jill Stein uses people's emotions against them. That she goes, oh, you guys care emotionally about this cause? I'll pay lip service to it because I don't actually ever have to make good on anything I'm saying because I'm never actually going to be elected. Let's talk about Jill Stein barely. She barely makes the cut. She's like half a percentage away from being entirely irrelevant. She's basically entirely irrelevant. Voting for nothing is nothing. People always say voting for the lesser of two evils is still evil. Well, voting for nothing is nothing. So, and nothing in the face of great evil, in the face of real hardship and upheaval in the world, doing nothing, I don't see how that is the morally superior position. If I can vote for less evil or vote for net neutral, just nothing, just go, I'm not going to participate. I think voting for less evil is the more moral position. Voting for incremental progress, voting for something is at least something. I don't know. The math seems pretty simple to me. It seems pretty easy. Odemia says, exactly. It's easy to pretend to care when you will literally never have to be accountable. Here's the thing about Jill Stein and the third party. And sure, let's talk about the Working Families Party that I just learned about today for the first time. Let's say that the Working Families Party, by some miracle, won the presidency in November. Let's say Jill Stein wins the presidency. She won't. They won't. But let's say that they do. What then? They have zero representation in Congress and the Senate. Do you know how hard it is for the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to get anything done because of the way that they can get stalemated by their political opposition in Congress and Senate? And they actually have their party in those positions? What in the wide world of fuck do you think your third party candidate is going to do in the executive branch of power when they try to push legislation through the House and the Senate? When they have to go up against the Supreme Court? How is that going to work? Even if they were able to get the power that they are claiming to seek, how would they actually make good on the promises they're making? The point is, they make those promises because they know they will never actually have to make good on them. They can say whatever. Jill Stein can say, day one, I'm going to issue a check for $1 million to every single person who votes for me. Sure, why not? Go ahead, say it. She's never going to have to do it. She can say whatever she wants. She knows that there are enough people who feel aggrieved enough by the Democratic Party's support of Israel that she can siphon those votes. And all she's looking for is a payday. Bottom line, Benjamin Netanyahu wants Donald Trump to win. Donald Trump loves Jill Stein. The Republican Party loves what Jill Stein is doing. Again, this isn't hard math. The math is not hard. Where you are coming from, where you are getting stuck, is that you have a justified emotional resentment. That is where you are getting stuck. You go, no, 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 no. I know I'm right. I know I'm right. I have been legitimately wrong. The Democratic Party has done real harm. I know I'm right about this. And I know I'm right to stick to my guns on this. And to a certain extent, yeah, sure. I was right, dude. I was right. That guy should not have stood in front of me when I was trying to film my video. He fucked my video up, and he didn't have to. And he was in the wrong, and I was in the right. Didn't fix anything for me to go and start shit with him. Didn't matter. I've never had anything fixed by pursuing a justified resentment. It's kind of all you have. It's just a justified resentment. Yeah, so this is Pablo Riboldi says, not true. It puts direct pressure on Harris to adopt a harder stance on Israel. I think that there's a good faith argument that can be made to show that the pressure that has been put on the Democratic Party by a lot of their voters, people who are committed to voting for them and people who are committed to voting third party and doing a protest vote, the pressure that has been put on them to be stronger when it comes to Israel has been not entirely fruitless. I think there's a good faith argument that can show that I don't think we would have this announcement from Biden that he is announcing an arms embargo, giving Bibi Netanyahu a 30-day window, saying you have 30 days to discontinue your behavior, to change your behavior, or we're done. You could make an argument that, to say that we wouldn't have that without people putting sufficient pressure on them. And I think that's a fair argument. I think that's I totally think that is a fair and valid position. I think that it's totally fair to say we should pressure our elected representatives. We should let them know what we value and what we care about. We should let them know when they disappoint us, when they let us down, when they use our money in ways that we disagree with. We should. There is a push and pull to this, though, because holding the entire country ransom for your hardline sticking issue is counterproductive. Because I think that you can say, hey, I want to be really clear here. I disagree with this, and I'm holding your feet to the fire, and we're all going to call you out and let you know how disappointed we are, and still understand the existential threat posed by Donald Trump and the Conservative Party, and still understand I still got to fill that ballot out Harris Walz. That's the only way to go. That's the only viable option I have. And you can do both of those things. What makes people increasingly take third-party voters or protest voters less seriously is when you see the pressure being applied and working, even if it's insufficient, even if it's incremental, even if it's too little too late, you see that pressure working and you see those people, rather than moving toward the ticket and going, I like that. I liked that I asked for something and you responded. You didn't give me everything I wanted, but you at least heard me out. Thank you. And now I'm going to move one step closer to voting for you. What we see instead is they get what they were looking for and they move one step back and they move the target and they move the goalpost. You can only get away with pulling the cookie away, yanking the football out of the way, moving the goalpost, moving the target so many times before people stop taking you seriously. In a negotiation, when you're trying to get things, when you're saying, hey, we want this in the contract, and then they cave and they go, okay, you can get that in the contract, you need to move one step closer to having a signed contract. You can't go, cool, we got that, and then back away. Maybe you can do that move, and maybe you can get away with doing that move 5, 6, 7 times. After a certain point, though, they're going to go, cool, you're no longer negotiating in good faith. We're trying to meet you on your terms, and you're not showing up for your end of the deal. So I think that you can make a good faith argument about putting pressure on and the way that that can work, but you've got to hold up your end of the bargain and go, okay, all right, I see you. I see you making concessions because of the pressure. Thank you. It's still not perfect. It's not ideal, but we are moving in the right direction. I will vote for you over Donald Trump. But if the response is, cool, thanks for doing that, fuck you, you'll never get my vote, I'm still going to throw my vote away and protest, I don't know. I think that you harm the cause of being able to put that pressure on effectively going forward because you're no longer negotiating in good faith. Ender's Menagerie says, we can't help anyone outside the U.S. if we lose our rights as citizens first. I see a lot of people saying this who are protest voters, you know, oh, you're willing to throw Gaza under the bus so that you don't lose rights. And again, justified resentment. I think a lot of these people feel like Americans don't deserve freedom, don't deserve rights, don't deserve protection, don't deserve safety if we can't ensure safety for the people in Gaza. There's this line of like, none of us are free until we're all free. All of this stuff really resonates. I vibe with all this stuff. I'm like, hell yeah, absolutely. We need to fight, you know, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Like, we need to fight for the freedom of all people, for the freedom and dignity of all people. That being said, there is a lot of validity to the argument of you can't really do a lot of pragmatic productive fighting if you are willing to cede all of your footing and all of your leverage, you know? If you're willing to just let your country devolve into authoritarian fascism and let Trump take over as a dictator and, you know, instill two more Supreme Court justices and set back progress decades in the country, what hope do you have of achieving any of your progressive goals? How does that actually serve the end game of your progressive goals? You need to be thinking strategically. You need to be making, like, people tell me this, that their protest vote is a chess move. It's not a tantrum. It's a chess move. Well, if it is a chess move, it's a bad one. It's not a very productive or smart chess move. You are basically throwing away the rights of everybody and abandoning the safety and the well-being of the people in Gaza in the interest of, like, some potential future revolution. You know, like some idea of like, we're going to break the duopoly going forward in the future. And it's like, well, but why are you willing to sacrifice everyone? Like your chess move is like, I'll kill everyone. I'll give you all my pawns and my knights and my rooks so that I can make this move. Because I think I'm going to win in three games. I'll sacrifice the next three games because I think after that I'm going to win. And it's like, but you can actually make moves to play this game. You don't have to do that. I don't think it's a very smart strategy. I don't think that you're actually thinking very pragmatically about your strategy. And again, it seems to be hypocritical because your number one cause seems to be fighting for justice for these people, fighting for the liberation of these people. And yet you're also saying, if I can't get it 100% the way I want it right now, I'm willing to throw the entire thing out. I will hold the line and be a hard line about having the exact kind of solution I demand right now. And if I can't get that, I'm cool with having nothing. And that doesn't... Somebody just said, these people, give me a break. Give me a break. Stop being... Don't do that. Don't introduce some bad faith argumentative tactic to be like, he said these people. Yeah, you fucking know what I'm saying. Give me a fucking break. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. It's like, this is why it's so hard for me to try to remain calm and engage in good faith with protest voters and third party voters, because they do this shit. They're constantly moving goalposts, they're constantly moving the target, and they're constantly arguing in bad faith. When you take away all of their arguments, when you take away all of their position, they just start doing stuff like that. They just start being like, oh, well, you said something that sounds like we could vaguely twist it into a way that says that you're racist, so ha-ha, ha-ha-ha-ha, and it's like, you're not being serious. This is why people don't take you seriously. Yeah, Wiseacre says, they aren't interested in answers, just their turn to talk. It really does feel like that a lot of the time. I can't tell you how many videos I've made on this topic where, like, people in the comments are just saying things that I already, like, direct quotes of arguments that I directly addressed. Like, I'll say that line about, like, oh, you say that the lesser of two evils is still evil. Well, you know, nothing is still nothing, and the greater good still matters. And I'll address that argument directly, and then in the comments, some Stein voter, some protest voter will be like, you know, the lesser of two evils is still evil. And I'm like, I said that. I literally addressed that argument directly in my video. And just, you know, they're not actually interested in engaging in the conversation in good faith. They're just waiting to say their thing, to repeat their slogan. They're not actually listening and considering, maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe there's a different way to approach this. They're just waiting to spam the comments with their stupid slogan. And it's so hard to take these people seriously and to engage in good faith. And I'm pretty much done with it, to be honest. Like, this is kind of like my last stitch effort to reason with these people before the election. Again, it's not hard math. There's nothing new about the third party plan. There's nothing new about the plan to say we're trying to get to 5% for the future of the American electoral system to challenge the duopoly. That's not a new idea. That's not a new plan. That's always been the plan of third-party voters and protest voters. It's never worked before. It's always been based in some kind of need or desire to punish the Democratic Party or to punish the establishment powers. It's never worked. It's never been productive. The math isn't hard. The thing you're doing has been done before. It's never worked. There are viable options on the table that actually have the chance of actually helping people. And you are actively not choosing those options because you want to pursue a justified resentment. And I'm just saying, please reconsider. If there's any part of you that's actually open to listening and to considering that maybe the way that you're doing things could be a little immature and a little just emotional or a little short-sighted, or just, I don't know, if you don't like any of those words, that maybe it's just that, like, acting out on in anger, acting out, even if it's justified, even if it's righteous anger, if there's some part of you that can see how that doesn't work, how historically that has not been a strong strategy, then this is me asking you to please reconsider before you cast your vote in November. Okay, that's it. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Patreon.com/AustinArcher is a thing that you can support. Thank you to all of my Patreon patrons. Thank you for keeping this going. Thank you to everybody that was throwing out tips in the TikTok chat. Thank you so much for the support. Thank you for keeping the chat so lively and productive today. This was a really, really good conversation, really good comments. Thank you, everybody, so much for being here and for watching and for listening and for considering. Vote.org, make sure you're registered to vote. Okay, get out there. Let's make history. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. If you want to hang out in the chat, we can stay live for a little bit, but I'm going to end the podcast. Okay. Bye, everybody. Goodbye. Goodbye. See you next time. Bye.